become a tradition here each fall to take up these stories of Zen ancestors of lineage from the Denkoku, the transmission of light record, the lives of our Zen family ancestors, and particularly the way they met each other, the relationships between them, and the light that was revealed in these meetings. The inconceivable light of awareness itself that we all share. The light that can't be seen but that shines on everything and illuminates everything. The light that doesn't come and go and is not more in Buddhas and less in deluded beings. The light that never goes dim, even when the breath stops and the heart ceases. The light that doesn't get brighter at birth, the light that's not brighter in the summer and dimmer in the winter. We celebrate this light. Our true nature, our true self, is nothing but this light. So we've heard that about 2,500 years ago, Shakyamuni Buddha manifested in this world of difficulty and suffering, discovering every facet of this light and conveying it to others. And his disciple Mahakashyapa, when the Buddha held up a flower and Mahakashyapa smiled, he received a complete taste of this one light. And Mahakashyapa was able to convey this light to his disciple Ananda, the second ancestor in India. And Ananda then met Shanavasa, the third ancestor. That's where we've gotten up to so far in this record. The third ancestor we chanted this morning, his name is Shonawashu Daiyosho. We chant all these names in the morning, right? And in Sesshin, we might wonder why we should bother, especially with a small group chanting such a long list of names. But I feel like particularly this Sesshin, we're really celebrating this transmission of light through all these ancestors. So even if we don't know the people behind all those names, we know they were people who passed this light down to the present, passed them, maybe we could say passed the appreciation of the light that we all share down to the present. And celebrating these stories, then we maybe do have a little sense of this. Maybe tomorrow when we chant Shonawashu Daiyosho, maybe now we'll have a little image, a story to go with that name. So, The third ancestor was Shanavasa. He asked Ananda, "What kind of thing is the original unborn nature of all things?" Ananda pointed to a corner of Shanavasa's robe. Again, Shanavasa asked, "What kind of thing is the original nature of the Buddha's awakening?" Ananda then grasped a corner of Shanavasa's robe and pulled it. At that time, Shanavasa was greatly awakened. That's our story for today. The meeting of the second and third Indian ancestors of Zen. And then this record is by Keizan Zenji, a couple of generations after Dogen in Japan. And for those who haven't heard of him, we consider Dogen and Keizan to be kind of like co-founders of Soto Zen lineage in Japan. They didn't ever meet each other. They lived almost a century apart. And yet, they each expressed the light so beautifully and uniquely that we consider them the creators of this unique style. Dogen and Keizan, a little bit different style. I would say, in general, the difference in emphasis is that Keizan is really into this Buddha nature light. And as some reality that we can actually taste and experience directly. So Keizan collected these stories and then he comments on them. So, and he's using other old Zen records from China to tell about their lives, but then he gives his own commentary on these stories. So now Keizan is just reciting telling us a little bit about the circumstances of his ancestor's life from these old records. The master, meaning Shanavasa, was a man of Mathura in northwestern India. In India, he was called Shanakavasa, which here in Japan and America means natural clothing. His name, Shanavasa, means natural clothing, like organic cotton. Even more natural than that, as we'll see. Shanavasa was born wearing clothes, and later the clothes became cool in summer and warm in winter. When he aroused bodhicitta, the aspiration for awakening, and left home as a monk, his layman's clothes were spontaneously transformed into monk's clothes, just like an incident recounted concerning the nun lotus color during the Buddha's lifetime. I don't know what that incident was, but I guess that's what happened with the nun lotus color. When she left home, her clothes were spontaneously transformed into her nun's robes. When Shanavasa was a merchant long ago, in a previous lifetime, he presented 100 lengths of woolen cloth to 100 Buddhas. Since then, as a result of this offering, he wore this natural clothing over many lifetimes. So, long, long ago, many lifetimes ago, Shanavasa in some other body with some other name, offered clothing to many Buddhas, and the result of that wholehearted, selfless offering was that he was actually born with this natural clothing. So sometimes in the old Indian stories we hear these stories of cause and effect like this, and they might seem kind of naive to us in modern times, but we don't know whether to take this kind of thing literally or figuratively, but in any case, it seems that the spirit of this is that the effects of selfless giving last for a long time, and the effects of harming others also last for a long time. In other words, everything we do makes a difference, and continues to ripple out into the universe for a long, long time. So this natural clothing, it's hard to imagine what exactly this is, right? So, and is this something literal also, or is this actually just Shanavasa's true nature, his natural clothing that he was born with in lifetime after lifetime? Maybe like the same natural clothing that we all wear lifetime after lifetime. But maybe in his case, he could see it a little bit too. So Kazan goes on to say, the time between when people die and are reborn is called the intermediate period, the antarabhava, or more well known by the Tibetan term bardo, you know, this time between two lives. And Kazan says, during this time, these intermediate beings have absolutely no clothing. You might think, what kind of clothes do they wear in between lives, these invisible beings? He says, no clothing. But in the present case of Shanavasa, he wore this natural clothing even during this intermediate period between lives. Born with it, died with it, and even in between lives, when there's no physical body, he wore this natural clothing. So we might start to get a sense of what kind of clothing this could be, that could be worn even without a human body, a physical body. Also, in India, Shanavasa is the name of a grass called Nine Branch Splendor. When a saintly person is born, this grass grows on pure ground. This grass grew when Shanavasa was born, hence his name. He was born after being carried in the womb for 6 years. Sometimes you hear that kind of story too in these ancient tales. Is that possible? Maybe it's something about his natural clothing prevented his earlier birth. So he was just swimming around in his natural clothing in the womb for 6 years, not feeling it was so necessary to come out into the world yet. In ancient times, the world-honored one, the Buddha, pointed to a lush, verdant forest and told Ananda, this grove is called Ulumanda, and 100 years after my death, there will be a monk named Shanavasa, and he will turn the wheel of the wondrous Dharma here. Shanavasa was born here after 100 years. Later, he received the Venerable Ananda's transmission and stayed here at that grove. He turned the wheel of Dharma and vanquished a fire dragon. The dragon submitted to him and presented him with the grove. Another record says the dragon took refuge in the three treasures with Shanavasa. Truly, this was all in accordance with the world-honored one's prediction. So these Indian ancestor stories have a lot of this kind of like magical occurrences and predictions of the future, prophecies, and so on. The Venerable Shanavasa was originally a wizard or a sorcerer. There's ways to translate this Chinese word, who lived in the Himalaya mountains. He joined with the Venerable Ananda, and so we have this story. So that's a little bit of the background of this ancient ancestor just after the Buddha's time, probably about 500 or 400 BC in India. Kazan says, this question, what kind of thing is the original unborn nature of all things, is truly a question no one had ever asked before this. Shanavasa alone asked it. There is no one who's not born with this original unborn nature of all things, but no one knows it and no one asks about it. Why is it called unborn nature? Even though the myriad things are born from it, this nature is not something which is born or created or produced. So it's called unborn nature. It is wholly the original unborn. Or another translation is, therefore everything is originally unborn. Mountains are not mountains, and rivers are not rivers. Therefore, Ananda pointed to a corner of Shanavasa's robe. So, the unborn is one of these Zen terms that gets used a lot. Unborn original nature. Emphasizing that our original nature is not produced or created. It's not born and it doesn't die. We, as people, seem to be born and seem to die, but this Buddha nature is not something like that. Not some created, conditioned phenomena that arises and ceases, is born and passes away. Now, we might feel like that's kind of some abstract teaching that we hear from time to time, and what's it got to do with our actual practice of Zazen? I think this is a great question, because here we are in Sesshin. We have period after period of silent sitting to settle into the present and let go of whatever we're holding on to, and open to some peacefulness. But along with this, at the same time, we can explore this teaching of the unborn original nature of ourself and all things. As you may have heard me offer this type of meditation, please excuse me for saying again that I think a really maybe in a way easy way to open to this is to actually, while we're sitting quietly and somewhat settled, putting aside our incessant obsessions with what's going on, it's hard to put them aside completely, right? But just, you know, coming into the present basically, and being somewhat settled and ready to investigate what's happening right here and now, then we can ask, is there an awareness here? That's another name for the light. Is there light here? Is there a light of knowing? I'd be like, well, I'm actually half asleep. It seems like if it's light, it's very dim light. Well, even if it might seem like dim light, we can still ask, is there a light that's shining as a kind of open knowing of the present at every moment, even in the midst of our churning obsessions about past and future? Is there this light? I'd say, yeah, but so what? That's not going to help me now, you might feel. But we can keep investigating this light. We can ask, well, how do we know that there is such a light? How do we know that there is awareness? Maybe, again, seems like a kind of silly question, but by asking it sincerely, how do I know I'm aware right now? By asking it, the attention that's going out into ideas and concepts and experiences in the so-called outer world withdraws a little bit, turns back a little bit. How do I know that I'm aware? We can't look out there to answer such a question, right? How do I know I'm aware? And it maybe doesn't seem like such a clear-cut answer, but in a way, I think it's a very simple reality that, well, awareness knows it's aware. There's nobody else in addition to awareness that knows it's aware. And by asking this question and looking and seeing, there is definitely an experience of being aware right now. And awareness seems to actually know that it's aware. Awareness can confirm that it's aware. There's nobody else that can do that but awareness. We can do this right now, even while listening to words and so on. There is a light of knowing. And the light knows itself. We know that we're knowing. Now we're already a little less involved by asking these questions. Is there awareness? And how do I know there's awareness? Where the light is now not so outwardly directed. So now we can explore this awareness and look for some kind of edges or boundaries. It seems like the light actually continues to radiate endlessly in all directions, because this light is not actually like some spatial phenomena anyway. It's just boundless, radiant light. But by actually looking for some edges, as if it's some sort of bubble or sphere, we might feel as if, or that our awareness fills this room, but it doesn't go outside the room. We can explore such things and see that actually, that's just a visual thing, that awareness seems to fill the room. But it doesn't really end at the walls of the room, right? So now we're awareness is not just the awareness we're talking about here, the light is not just a visual consciousness. It's not just an auditory consciousness that ends at the sounds at the end of the block and can't hear sounds further. We're talking about something that's not one of the senses. Not even mental consciousness, really, but more like boundless knowing that doesn't even need objects in order to radiate. And then we might have some sense of that, and we might feel like kind of uncomfortable, but still have some sense of this light that's pervading the uncomfortableness. And then later on, we might feel quite comfortable and at ease. And we'll also notice there's this light that's pervading the comfortable ease. And then we could see, is that knowing light that's the same in both these experiences, is that the same light? It might seem like, well, yeah, this knowing doesn't seem to actually change when the experiences change, does it? Doesn't it seem that there's a knowing awareness in every single experience we've ever had? Every conscious experience, there's a kind of knowing of it. And the knowing of it doesn't come and go while the experiences do come and go. So that's why it's sometimes called the unborn nature of mind or awareness, because it's not coming, it's not born when our experiences are born, and it doesn't go when our experiences go. It's unchanging, but it's not something. It's unborn. So maybe we can open to this unborn nature of mind, nature of awareness. But that sounds different from the unborn original nature of all things. That's what's being asked about here, the unborn original nature of all things. So if we have some sense of the unborn nature of awareness, we can then, from this perspective of awareness, start investigating things. And try to see if these so-called things are objects of the five senses. Forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile experiences, and also thoughts and emotions and mental objects. All these things, these dharmas, these phenomena. Is it that awareness actually goes out and touches these things? If it were so, then awareness would be limited and would stop at the things. But can we open to this different perspective? I think this is an unusual and different perspective. But there were actually, we can look at our experience in this way without changing our experience. It's a shift of perspective to see that actually these things, this book out here, is actually an expression of the awareness itself. The light, the awareness, is taking form as an object. This is a different perspective. Usually we have a sense, well, there's an eye that's looking at a visual object of a book. There's a hand that's touching a solid tactile book. There's an ear that hears the sound of a book. But that's our usual way of experiencing. But this way is like, once we're in touch with this sense of the boundlessness of awareness, which is not something so obscure, not something, I think if we feel that that's something too way outside my experience, it's too abstract and I can't get into that. In Sishin, we might be able to open to this. I think it's not really so extraordinary at all. I think it's very ordinary. But it's a shift of perspective. We need, our mind has to be kind of flexible to have this sense that awareness doesn't really meet an actual real object out here, but that the object is part of the awareness. We have to be very, very present and attentive and curious to sense this different perspective. We're so accustomed to relating to the world as if it is things outside of awareness. But without moving a particle, as Dogen says, without a hair's breadth of changing anything, looking very closely at the meeting place of awareness and book, or any object, can we open to even the possibility that the object is actually the awareness, the light itself, transformed into objects, not in some magical strange kind of way, but just the way that it's actually always been. Awareness is boundless and includes everything and doesn't come and go. If it includes everything, then how can there be things that actually really do come and go? Of course they appear to come and go and they appear to be things. But what if it's all actually made of this one unborn awareness? Then we can see, we can ask the question, what is the original unborn nature of all things? All things now are not actually things that are actually born and cease. They're actually part of the unborn, unceasing awareness. Yes.
So my sense is you can ask the question, but then we come to that idea of not knowing versus knowing. And I think with the question comes, hopefully after a period of time, a willingness and a letting go into not knowing. So that maybe, so in a way I'm kind of having dialogue with you about that, that we don't ever know. Awareness maybe doesn't even ever know what awareness is, but doesn't know, but is. And there's some way that we can let go into being in that, seeing, having let go of the obstructions to that, you know, the layers that cover that. In my experience, things you could call magic, only because we're not used to them.
Yeah, because we're not used to them.
Start to happen, mm-hmm. And you start to get the impression that this is a different awareness I'm in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's right. If we're trying, our usual way of relating to the world and things is to try to know them, to know what they are. And knowing is a kind of, in Buddhism, knowing is a kind of getting a hold of something. That's what knowing generally means. So, we're very used to trying to know things by getting a hold of them. So this awareness is one thing that we cannot get a hold of as a thing. So in a way, you can say, yeah, we can't know it as an object. Sometimes it's also said, there is a kind of knowing, but not our usual kind of knowing, a knowing without touching things, a knowing without grasping objects, which is just the light itself. But even to call it knowing, we can say maybe better to call it not knowing, is I think what you're bringing up.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That in a sense, yeah. You know, that we do, there's something personal, something, we're in touch with something. We certainly can't express what infinity, you know, equated to Buddha nature.
Yeah, we can't get a hold of it, and yet these words of all the ancestors are trying to help open us to a new way of looking. And then that's the, you know, one pitfall for sure, is that then we try to get a hold of this new way of looking where it's more like a not knowing. Yeah. And I think that another way of talking about this unborn nature of awareness itself is that if any experiences are happening within it or as it, if awareness is manifesting as all these experiences, that means by definition that awareness is open to these experiences. In other words, we cannot have an experience of the world unless awareness says yes to it. So even if we're having a very painful, difficult experience, awareness, our true unborn nature, is saying yes to that. Otherwise, it could not be happening. Could you follow that? So this is part of the beauty of this unborn awareness, is it is incapable of resisting anything, any experience that's happening. Once an experience is happening, that means awareness has said yes to it, and awareness has is manifesting itself as this painful or pleasant experience. So we, as humans, we resist many things, right? But the unborn nature cannot resist anything. And resistance is basically the definition of suffering and discontent. So this is a kind of a practical implication of this kind of thing for Sesshin, because when we're in Sesshin, I predict I'll make a prophecy for this Sesshin. I predict that everybody in this room will have at least some time of resisting what's happening.
you're a sorcerer.
I may be wrong, but this is my prediction. And I include myself in this too, that I will not be completely blissfully open to every single moment of experience. But I propose that our unborn original nature of awareness is incapable of resisting. So even while I'm resisting, if I can remember this, if I can let the light start to permeate itself and get in touch with this awareness that's not resisting, then I, Kokyo, can still keep resisting, but I can start to appreciate there's this one who's not resisting, always not resisting, always saying yes. Because actually the painful experience is the awareness, right? All things are, from this perspective, made of the awareness. They are manifestations, they're expressions of the one awareness that we all share. All the birth and death expressions are manifestations of the unborn. So therefore the Heart Sutra says, emptiness itself is form. the unborn nature manifests as things, pleasant and unpleasant. So, people might sometimes forget, well, what's all the big deal about this awareness? But I think this is like the Zen tradition's unique cure for discontent and suffering. Discontent and suffering is we imagine that the painful situation is exists on its own, apart from awareness, and is just that way, and therefore we resist it and we suffer. But if we can, without making that go away, but at the same time, open to this unborn awareness, we can enjoy this one who's not suffering, who's not resisting, because the very situation is not actually the situation we think it is. It's actually the one unborn mind itself. So again, Shanavasa asked this question, what kind of thing, it's not really a thing, right? What kind of, what is this unborn, original, unborn nature of all things? And Kazan says, there's no one who's not born with the original unborn nature. But no one knows it, as Richard said. Nobody knows it, really, as some thing. And hardly anyone ever asks about it. So Shanavasa asks about it, and we can ask ourselves about it today. We have time to do this. And then Kazan again says, why is it called unborn nature? Even though the myriad things are born from it, this nature is not something which is born or created. Right? So the myriad appearances are so-called born from the unborn, or they're born as the unborn. They actually are the unborn, but they appear to be born. It is, therefore, everything is the original unborn. Mountains are not mountains, and rivers are not rivers. Right, from this perspective. Of course they appear as mountains. They will continue to appear as mountains and rivers, but they're not actually mountains and rivers. They're expressions of the unborn, ever-present, boundless, all-inclusive awareness. Everything is me, and I am everything. We can each say that. Kazan goes on to say, Kesa, or Sanskrit, Kashaya, this patched robe, including a rakasu, is called a kesa. Kesa is just the Japanese pronunciation of Kashaya, the Sanskrit word, which Kazan says means spoiled color, or indefinite mixed color, or unborn color. So that is unborn. I think he's stretching a little bit to make this, his point here, but literally Kashaya is something like mixed color, not a primary color. So that's why like brown is sort of like this murky blend of all colors. And we say when making Dharma robes, not to use, you know, just a primary color, but they're kind of mixed colors, and they often translate as ochre in the old sutras. They sometimes say, put on the ochre robe, but it's this word kashaya. that means like mixed color. And I think the idea is it's supposed to be like not so attractive. It's supposed to be a kind of like muddy color that people aren't really that into. So we don't get so attached to clothing, right? So then people don't want to steal the monk's robes that way. Nobody really wants, they're just a kind of muddy, patched up thing. So that's the spirit of Kashaya. Indefinite mixed color or unborn color. Kazan says, truly you should not see it as a color. You know, in our robe chant, we say, Muso fuku dene. We translate as field far beyond form and emptiness in our robe chant in the early morning. And literally it's Muso fuku dene is signless field of blessings, robe, signless blessing field, robe, Muso fuku dene. So it's signless, meaning it truly, strictly speaking, has no color. It has no signs or marks. You can't see it as some actual independently existing thing, but of course it seems to have a color, right? But Kazan says, truly do not see this robe as a color. It's a signless field of merit or blessings. Kazan says, in one sense, there is the color of the mind and body and external environment of all things. From Buddhas above to the ants, mosquitoes, and horse flies below. We see all these things as color, meaning like form and color. The mind, the body, and external environment of all things, from Buddhas above to ants, mosquitoes, and horseflies below. However, they are not truly form and color. Therefore, there are no three realms to leave and no fruit of the way to acquire. In other words, the three realms is the old Buddhist way of talking about samsara, the painful world of desire and form, and even the formless world are still part of the coming and going birth and death cycle of samsara. But if we see that these things are not truly form and color, therefore there's no samsara to leave. We don't have to escape from it, because it's not actually here in the first place. And we don't have to acquire the way, the great way, because it's not something to acquire outside of unborn awareness. And I like that he brings up, he says, in one sense, there is the color or form of mind and body and external environment. However, they are not truly form and color. So these three, I think, is an all-encompassing list of everything that we can possibly experience fits into body, mind, and environment. Mind here meaning like I would understand as experiences of emotions and feelings and thoughts and sensations and moods, that kind of mind, and the body we experience and the environment or world we experience. That's everything we experience, body, mind, and world. And all of them, and we could contemplate these one by one in Zazen, I find this kind of thing just very rewarding in Zazen, to contemplate the body from the point of view of awareness. We see the body is all these sensations, these tactile sensations. See how we, they could be actually just expressions of awareness. Rather than, we might think that the body and a physical brain are producing awareness. That's like total opposite view. That's this modern Western science. Right? This is like awareness manifests a brain and a body, and we experience it as tactile sensations with our eyes closed. With our eyes open, we can look at our body and experience it as a visual sensation. But to open to the possibility that this body may be made of awareness, and then mind, and all these obsessive thoughts of past and future, and not being good enough, and not being able to understand, and physical discomfort, and all of these mental arisings and ceasings, opening to how they're all the play of this one unborn awareness. And then the world, their environment, I think is exactly the same kind of category as just its experience. The world or environment is simply known to us as colors, sounds, smells, tastes, and physical sensations. That is the world. And, of course, mental concepts, packaging it together. So, body, mind, and world are actually, from the point of view of awareness, there aren't really a body, a mind, and a world that are actually born and die, but is the unborn awareness expressing itself as a body. So beautiful that this awareness expresses itself as a body. That's the miracle of human life. But is it an actual body somehow outside, separate from awareness? That's how it often seems. And the mind, these thoughts, can actually seem like they have a life of their own, right? Separate from awareness. And the world definitely seems like that will go on without our awareness. But again, this is just an experiential investigation. That the only way we know or experience the body, the mental phenomena, and the world or environment is through the awareness, as the awareness. The unborn awareness itself is all bodies, all minds, and all worlds. Body as sensations, mind as thoughts and feelings, world as perceptions. That's a contemplation you can take up. Body as physical sensations, mind as thoughts and emotions, let's say, and world as perceptions, five sensory perceptions. It's a different way of looking at body, mind, and world, but in fact that is the only experience we ever have of body, mind, and world. And if all these things are actually just expressions of the unborn awareness, then they themselves, too, are also unborn. This is the original unborn nature of all things and experiences. So, hope that's not too much to just dive into that right away, but there's no time to waste. And it's not just like, oh, I'm glad that kind of highfalutin Dharma talk is over. Now I can get back to my obsessions. This is our chance for, this is what we can do in Zazen, actually. And I think it is true that first we come to settle and relax and accept what's happening and become more and more present. Maybe not completely present, that's too high a standard, but basically here now in the room with whatever experience we're happening, and then gently and kindly and lovingly, because that's what this is all about actually, we can start to explore our own experience in this intimate, loving, kind-hearted way. And it slips away, and like, what was that again? That's totally fine. That's also an expression of the unborn. Dedicate the merit of our gathering together to practice the way of the ancestors to all these ancestors in their unborn space with us here still, embracing us in their kindness, our gratitude for them we offer back as this session. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.